And thank you so much, Dave, members of NEIS, and Lucas. Really moved by Dave's commitment to this activity for 30 years. More now? Is it 30-some?
35.
35 years. That is so, so amazing. And you create a setting to bring in people both over the long haul, not as long as yours, but also serendipitously today. So I'm really grateful, and I just want to honor. Okay. A number of years ago, Dave and I were sitting at a post-Fukushima, dog and pony show by experts at the University of Chicago. It was an infuriating and flabbergasting occasion, and at the end of it, it was a good thing I was sitting next to him. I just looked at Dave and I said, well, where were the people in this? Because there were no human beings that came up in the conversation of these experts whatsoever, as if the impact that that nuclear disaster could have on persons was inconceivable. And then a little bit after that, Dave asked me to do a presentation called Where Are the People? And remembering these exchanges we've had, I titled my presentation today, Men, Women, and Children, Other Living Things Last, because it seems to me that that is the bottom line of the nuclear age, that is, let me backtrack, and I'm sorry, I'm sounding, just stuffed up and obnoxious and very dry-mouthed, so bear with me. After Fukushima happened, and reflecting on my own relationship to the nuclear age, and when I was 10 years old, seeing the films released by, what was it called, the One Foot? Anyway, the movement by Japanese citizens to buy back documentary footage from the United States, which had been confiscated at the end of the atomic bombs. And so citizens pulled together money to buy a foot at a time or an inch at a time of documentary tape. And I still, when I was 10, early age for general TV ownership in Japan and seeing these grainy black and white images of what happened after the bomb and seeing the very famous shot of a boy sitting caught in profile in steps, burnt in, melted down into the granite. And that image that made me think, someday I really have to teach about Japan just to prevent war between the United States and Japan and to keep this from happening. That was one thought, the omnipotent notion of a child that you can do something that will prevent war forever. And the other was, how could grown-ups go around every day when something so alarming had in fact happened? How could they think that getting dinner ready or going to their jobs was as important as making sure that never happened again? In any case, it wasn't very long after that that the Japanese government embarked on a campaign to help Japanese people get over their nuclear allergy. It was very patronizingly put. It was all about the new nuclear energy program, and therefore you had to make a distinction between nuclear energy and nuclear weapons, and to be an advanced modern person in this country that was phenomenally, as we all know, arising from the ashes of war, reemerging, it was really important to accept nuclear energy. So I remember resisting, and yet thinking about for a long time, and again after Fukushima, that the place where we can see nuclear weapons and nuclear energy coming together was at this moment in 1953, December, when President David Dwight Eisenhower, who is one of the top American military brass who said the bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were unnecessary to end the war, nevertheless, in the course of his presidency and with the intensification of the Cold War, began to increasingly worry about the strain, if you will believe it, on the American budget of military expenditures. So in the shot in which he is addressing the United Nations General Assembly to announce the Atoms for Peace program, because on the one hand, concern about the military expenditures had led him to espouse the use of nuclear weapons as a cheaper benefit, cheaper option, and the alarm that was causing among United States allies, he decided that he needed to come up with a different way of spinning the nuclear age, and that was Atoms for Peace. As we know now, one of the first nations to be the beneficiary of this program was Japan. I think it was a senator from Illinois, not positive, who said, as a Christian nation, we owe no less to the Japanese, having dropped the atomic bombs on them, to give them the benefits of this technology. The program had kind of a setback, with 1954, March 1st, the Castle Bravo shot, huge explosion test. It really sparked housewives. It was the housewives of one ward in Tokyo to start an anti-nuclear movement that gathered, I think, millions of petitions. This is a day before internet. Just going door to door. And there was still that kind of sentiment available to being tapped in Japan and in the world. If you look at the Stockholm Declaration at that time, which also received enormous numbers of signatures. In any case, nuclear energy, despite this, I would say, mistiming, this shot and many, many others. Some of you may have heard about the Lucky Dragon, the tuna fishing boat that was caught in one of the U.S. tests, the Bikini test, and the captain came back, ended up dying shortly thereafter, but so much tuna had been offloaded already, this radioactive tuna, and consumed all over Japan. That is a famous episode. What we don't know is how many other fishing vessels were caught in that wake and how many other people consumed the goods and how much contamination took place all over Japan thanks to U.S. nuclear testing. And, it, of course, it's not just Japan. Pacific Island's a big place. There's something I learned about only recently called the MacArthur Line. Has anyone else heard of it? It was a line, you know, an imaginary line of cross drawn in the Pacific, which was to mark the areas that nobody should enter while the United States was testing. And it just wasn't well known enough, and it wasn't visible enough in the Pacific to protect people. In any case, for a long time, I've been thinking that this was the place where nuclear power and nuclear weapons really became linked. And only recently have I begun to think, you just have to go back to the very beginning, that this is a kind of strategic linkage which has been very powerful, which to this day continues to make it much, much easier for people to be opposed to nuclear weapons and not to nuclear power, especially in the age of global warming, thanks to the misleading notion that nuclear energy is a clean, green energy. But in the course of going back, and this is one of my themes today, and I'm very early on this research, so I'm tentative about it, but we go back to the very earliest eras of, very earliest eras would take us to the end of the 19th century, but okay, to the American nuclear program confronting World War II, just that end of it. Soviet Union has its own wretched story with techniques learned from the United States, we learn. But to see what was being concealed from people, workers especially, engaged in the nuclear industry. And we have to see also how the Japanese government was involved from very early on, not in being interested in protecting its citizens or seeking any kind of help for them after the bombs, but essentially in collaborating with the United States, both because there was strong pressure to do so, having been defeated in war, but also because of its own scientific program from during the war, too. Japan was also trying to develop nuclear weapons. And that takes me back to Hanford, the site in Washington State, one of the messiest cleanup sites to this day, very, very costly. And, you know, with contamination reaching the Columbia River, I believe, you have to worry about the whole area. You have to worry about the fragile livelihood of native tribes that depend on salmon fishing in those areas and depend on are not knowing and worrying about contamination. It's that kind of trap that is horribly painful. But in any case, in a book I recommend to all of you, it's 400-some pages and densely footnoted, but it is a page-turner. It's called Plutopia, that is to say plutonium, combination of plutonium and utopia. Plutopia by American historian Kate Brown, and it compares Hanford, or Richland, the town outside Hanford, and with a town, a comparable town in the Soviet Union, and it's quite extraordinary. But of this plant, where DuPont and the government had known from very early on the dangers of internal exposure for the workers. And Lucas was touching on it tacitly, but I myself was not sufficiently aware until Fukushima about the danger, the distinction between internal and external exposure. And when you're told, oh, stop worrying about radiation, you know, take a jet plane, dental x-ray, et cetera, well, I now like to minimize my dental x-rays too, but that we're talking about external sources of radiation, right? But if you're talking about internal exposure, that is to say you've ingested something, inhaled it, you had a cut on your skin in a highly dusty, contaminated place, then it's having a source inside your body that's going to continue to emit it's going to be a source of ionizing radiation that is going to specifically, because these radionuclides settle in different organs, targeting different parts of your body. And you all know the scary numbers or the dizzying numbers about half-lives. In any case, DuPont and the government knew about this danger, said nothing about it. But this is not after this plant, which made the plutonium for the Nagasaki bomb. I'm just going to quote from Kate's book. And continue to be a big producer of plutonium. In the summer of 1948, Herbert Parker was reluctant to begin regular urinalyses of Hanford workers because of at other Manhattan Project sites, such lead tests had, quote, led to considerable alarm among those who received positive results. Nonetheless, Hanford workers worried about plutonium in their bodies. It would be good for, quote, plant morale, Parker reasoned, to begin a testing program. But if the results were positive, then he would have an even greater morale problem. Parker worked his way out of the snare by devising a plan to test workers after long weekends. Testing after several days' leave gave workers time to urinate the most radioactive samples safely into their toilets at home. Another brilliant tactical move. With your analyses, workers felt safer, especially when the results were negative, and that was good for morale. And I think that could characterize a lot of the spirit of programs to protect workers. I want to quickly go to this shot of the buildings of the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission. There was also one set up in Nagasaki. It is now replaced by the Radiation Effects Research Foundation, RERF, which is binational, staffed by Americans and Japanese scientists and technicians. It was started up in 47, but in 1950, it started the long-term study of Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors, and which is still to this day considered the gold standard of health studies of survivors. I'm trying to sneer, indicate my sneering attitude towards this gold standard, since A, as the redoubtable Alice Stewart, does anyone know her? Redoubtable Alice Stewart, British pioneer epidemiologist. She's the one thanks to whom we no longer take fetal x-rays. She withstood a great deal of hostility and contempt and shaming to get there. She also did a long-term Hanford worker study. But in any case, as Alice Stewart pointed out many years ago, by 1950, right, the bombs were dropped in 45, by 1950, the most vulnerable members of the population would have died. You know, there were hard winters, the food scarcity. And so when you start studying in 1950, you're getting the hardiest part of the population, A, and B, the most upsetting part of, I think, of this study is it was not looking for, I'll just put it that, it was not looking for, it did not seek to look for internal exposure. And for many, many years, people denied it. Now, I'll come back to that topic, but look at these two photos. The ABCC was notorious. It was loathed and feared in the cities where they were established because they only measured, they only studied, they did not offer any treatment. In fact, the United States, not only was their press code censoring any information about the bombs, but once this was set in place, then there was, doctors were forbidden to study, scientists were forbidden to study anything about what had been dropped on their land, on their cities. But people would be swept up, it is said, often from schools, and kind, you know, exposed in this way, measured, blood tested, so forth and so on. Grieving families would be asked to give up the bodies of their loved ones so that for autopsy, in exchange, and this would not have been trivial in a poverty-stricken, defeated land. Money would be, funeral expenses would be paid for. I think about this young woman, at least she's covered over, faced with this white guy in a coat who doesn't speak her language and being measured, investigated, prodded, and knowing that there was nothing that was going to help her in terms of her own health. But I just think of the acute cultural discomfort. And I think in John Hersey's famous story, the minister's family, the Tanimoto's family, I heard last fall that the daughter in that family decided in her teens, probably when she hit puberty, that she was no longer going to cooperate. You know, thank you, no matter what, you can't get me to go back, and that she was going to write about it. And so that would be very important work to deal with. Now, what's important to realize is that there are indications that there were Japanese scientists who tried to do extend research on their own in here, who were also curious about internal exposure and could not, structurally could not pursue it. But it's also important to remember that the Japanese authorities were fully cooperative. In fact, they had begun their own study of the impacted well before surrender. So I think around August 10th, there were studies that were commencing on the bombed, A-bomb population in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, this data handed over to the occupation authorities after surrender and occupation. So this notion of getting information but not informing the people who needed it the most, those who are impacted and those who care for them, goes very, very far back. And I just want to show this every chance I have because I find it so dramatic and so useful. And it's the cover, you know, a very dreary government report cover by the Senate subcommittee to the House Energy Committee, and the title is American Nuclear Guinea Pigs, Three Decades of Radiation Experiments on U.S. Citizens. I think that too represents very much a strong undercurrent from the beginning of the nuclear age. Developing the atomic weapons was important to defeat the Nazis, yes, but it also gained its own momentum. There's also the scientific imperative. I often think back to the Manhattan scientists at the University of Chicago doing that experiment on an urban campus when they really didn't know what was going to happen. Why do scientists get to have their dreams answered if they can get the funding, which they case, that case they did? Why is there something special so to be unquestioned about their imperative to find their kind of truth? Anyway, I mean, we can argue about this a long time, but I think it's worth questioning sometimes. This is a wonderful thing. You can read it online now. It makes good reading, interesting reading. It is, I like to say, in Chicago, that the University of Chicago was involved in it too. You can get reports of experiments conducted at Billings. But I'm particularly intrigued by sections about the University of Chicago, like 1960 to 64, I think. There was a report conducted on, an experiment conducted on, I believe it was 104, it might be 102, undergraduates and staff. And it consisted of feeding them, one-third of them, radioactive fallout from the Nevada testing ground. Radioactive fallout. Feeding another third artificially produced radioactive materials, and a control group that got nothing. And the terse conclusion at the end of that section is no follow-up was conducted. And it makes you wonder is it possible that these experiments were conducted for 30 years and follow-up not conducted? I mean, what would be the point of experimenting? Informed consent wasn't established then, so we don't know much. And this particular section is not particularly illuminating as to whether these students or departmental administrators were told what they were doing. I, as a student, would have found it very hard if a professor had said, do you want to take part in a really important scientific experiment that benefits our country, too? It'd be very hard to say no, wouldn't it? When this was released, there was an attempt by its author today, the other senator from Massachusetts, Senator Ed Markey, was the author of this report, tried to get the responsible parties to pursue, look into the survivors, follow up on their health, and offer some sort of compensation. But such efforts were nixed by Presidents Reagan and Bush. So this remains a buried document. The media weren't much interested in it either. All right, let's pick up the story here. These two slides. This gentleman, Dr. Itsuzo Shigematsu, was maybe about the second, was ahead of the, he died only a few years ago, of the RERF, the successor organization of the notorious ABCC. And he is the person who was tapped by the International Atomic Energy Agency, you know, the international agency that's supposed to provide us security through their watchfulness about nuclear materials and to promote the peaceful use of nuclear energy. He was tapped by the IAEA to do a Chernobyl study. 1990 began. The study came in 1991. He's a remarkable man. He found that there had been no health effects, no ill health effects. This is 1991, this report was released, and after the Chernobyl disaster. And instead, he found radiophobia. That is to say, it was psychological worry about the effects of exposure that contributed to many of the, we all know that stress isn't good, right? It's not good for health. Living in contaminated areas, having lived through such a traumatic episode, would necessarily bring on stress, and that whatever one saw could be attributed to radiophobia. Radiophobia has a very long life. I don't know that we'll ever succeed in killing it, because it has been wonderfully recycled in Fukushima. The thing about this man, Dr. Shigematsu, is that he's used repeatedly for this kind of purpose. The fact that he was an expert from Hiroshima gave him the credentials to head to be tapped by the IAEA, and to produce the to make those implausible results credible. That is what I'm now beginning to understand. It was in his bent, though. I mean, because I've learned that only yesterday, though, I keep wanting to show you these Norwegian reindeer contaminated by Chernobyl. That he found in Minamata mercury poisoning that there had been no health effects. In cadmium poisoning, no health effects. He seems to be particularly good at getting large, huge budgets, government budgets, to study terrible environmental episodes and to say with a straight face that there were no ill effects, that health had been okay, that the industrial age could continue as we had come to know and love it. Professor Yamashita, some of you may know him. Well, he's the radiation risk, health risk advisor of Fukushima Prefecture. He's a second generation hibakusha from Nagasaki. His parents were there at the time of the bomb, which gives him tremendous credentials too, right? He took part in a massive Chernobyl study also, not that long after Dr. Shigematsu, and he did find pediatric thyroid cancer as one of the effects. It is really the only ill that is officially recognized by official sources, by which I mean Western, UN-related, U.S. sources, pediatric thyroid cancer, although if you read it, anything at all, you know that there are so many other effects that are associated. Cardiovascular problems, eye issues, chronic fatigue syndrome, so many diffuse and yet debilitating effects. So Dr. Yamashita was very useful, important for Chernobyl. But what happens when he's sent to Fukushima? Something happens. He starts telling people that you can be, this is better to tell. He says, people who laugh a lot aren't affected by radiation. You know, laugh a lot and you'll be fine. You can stand exposure up to 100 millisievert a year. The International Commission for Radiological Protection, you have to learn these New Deal-like alphabet soup acronyms, but ICRP even says that for the regular public, 1 millisievert a year. And he says, up to 100, why not? So he is both massively hated and depended on in different ways, depended on by the authorities to keep anxiety under control, and depended on by the people who feel they have no option but to continue to live there, who don't want to be worried, who especially don't want to have to worry about the children who are dependent on their parents to look out for their health in a time when school lunches are about sound environmental principles keep being announced in Fukushima, like local growth, local consumption, right? Which is good in general, maybe not so good in Fukushima, especially if you're not sure that the food that's gone into your child's school lunch has really been tested, and whether that testing is to be relied on. Very hard in a, believe in Japanese exceptionalism. Like, you know, so many analyses of Japan end up with saying, well, there's something very special about Japanese culture, something very special about Japanese attachment to their land, et cetera, et cetera. But it is a very small island country, and disasters make everyone anxious. And so it is very hard for parents who are worried to send children with their, even if they can secure permission from the school board to send their own lunches. It's very hard because the parents and the child face ostracism. So that kind of thing. Yamashita has been very useful in those ways. I want to, in the interest of time, the ways in which I began to feel envious, as I said, of about Chernobyl. I'll just show you this slide now. This is this press conference took place in March 12th, a week ago. It is the newly formed Thyroid Cancer Family Association press conference announcing their launch. I thought, that's fantastic, because it's been so hard. Now, right now, the official count, according to the prefectural monitoring, the scans of child and youth pediatric thyroid cancer, is 166 cases of confirmed and suspected. So this is post-scans and biopsy, in many cases, thyroidectomy. I'm also learning from this that pediatric thyroid cancer is not what I had thought. You know, if you remember the odious George Monbiot, M-O-M-B-I-O-T, and somebody, professor at the College of London, right after Fukushima, George announced that it was Fukushima that made him pro-nuclear, because not a single person had died, and thyroid cancer is the easiest cancer to deal with. And anyway, what I'm beginning to learn is that often thyroid cancer indeed can usually be dealt with, but actually pediatric thyroid cancer often will have metastasized to the lymph nodes. That has already happened. The naysayers, you know, pediatric thyroid cancer occurs at the rate of 1 to 2 in a million. And now, and 166 is an order of magnitude above that. And in the sublime way of Japanese officials, what they say every time there's an announcement is, it is difficult to believe that there is an association between the nuclear disaster and this incidence of thyroid cancer. In any case, this is a wonderful occasion. And yet, what troubled me is, this is how the press conference took place. So these are the journalists and the two parents. There are only five families so far that have joined, appeared by Skype. Their faces were never shown, and their voices were altered. It was called a coming out. But what a coming out is that? What kind of a coming out where you have to hide your face and your voice altered? And that you as a victim cannot show yourself. You want to protect your child's privacy, to be sure. And their children have suffered already a great deal. It is not an easy thing to be told when you're a child that you have cancer. But at the same time, it's part of the government campaign to bring everybody back, to make sure that everything is cleaned up by the Tokyo Olympics. I would like to be able to mount some kind of opposition to the Tokyo Olympics, to 2020. It is not a good thing to support that. It is not a good thing. It is an excuse to siphon resources away that are desperately needed in Fukushima, but more than that, to augment the concealment distortion campaign, as Jeff Patterson, whom Dave is often rightly fond of quoting, scum, secrecy, cover-up, minimization, wherever the nuclear industry is composed. The Tokyo Olympics are a huge, huge occasion for scum. So with Fukushima people, right, it's so often the most vulnerable who have to contribute to their own further victimization, who can't afford to move out, who need continued employment. It is also those who have lost their means of livelihood who are doing the decontamination work in Fukushima and the decommissioning. It is Lucas's presentation made me realize again and again that only decades and decades and decades and decades of mitigation are foreseen for Fukushima, not anything that we might call decommissioning. And Japanese say enviously nowadays, because of the 5 and 30 conjuncture, in Chernobyl they managed to put up the sarcophagus in 7 months. Well, we don't have anything contained in Fukushima. I met a friend who's a hydrologist, and he says, oh, you know, we hydrologists proposed underground barriers to keep that contaminated water from sloshing out, but our plans weren't accepted. I don't know what it is, but the construction industry seemed to get the better of the hydrologists. And watching Lucas's presentation again made me think, maybe in a society that's fully capitalist, even at the time of this disaster, you just got so much competition among different industries that could realize a big profit, that even those plans are seriously jeopardized all the time. So you have, and the other thing which keeps these parents with their heads covered and their faces covered and their voices altered, is prejudice. I think discrimination, I'm beginning to think discrimination might have been one of the most, I say this ironically, useful results of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. Discrimination from fellow Japanese, because you don't want your gene pool contaminated by the gene pool of anyone who suffered from the atomic bombs. And in this, if you see this woman at the edge of the screen here, she announced herself in this press. She didn't seem to be a journalist, but she said that she's a Hiroshima survivor. She's 70 years old, so she must have just been born. She too has suffered from thyroid cancer and lung cancer and all kinds of ills along the way, and that she's been able to survive. Why? For two reasons: solidarity with many comrades, and the health booklet, the Hibakusha health booklet. And that too is a source, again, of great division today. People are saying there is need for a health booklet in Fukushima, but should it be called a Hibakusha, you know, a radiation survivor booklet, as it has been in Hiroshima? There are many Hiroshima and Nagasaki victims, I learned, 25 years ago even, who didn't accept that guarantee of free medical care because they were afraid that it would prejudice their children's chances for employment and marriage. And the same worry abounds in Fukushima today. And I was very interested by this woman's question and hope that there would be more communication between her and these parents. I want to just call your attention to this. I find it really, really hard to find anything in English about what in Japanese is called the Chernobyl Act, which was established 5 years after. So right as the Soviet, the 1990, it's in August of 19, no, just as close to when the Soviet Union is being dissolved, but it's established under the Soviet Union, adopted subsequently in the independent nations of Belarus, Russia, and Ukraine. And Japanese, again, this is something that Japanese invoke with great envy. This is Alexander Velkin. Finally found him in English, but not saying nothing about him. A liquidator, former liquidator, who has been invited numerous times to Japan. And I'm sorry, I could not find a decent chart like this to English, and I couldn't translate it in time. But as you can imagine, this is in the case of Russia, and this was in 2012, and he was saying, these are the standards prevailing in our country now. The reddest zone is the exclusion zone, and over 5 millisieverts a year is an area that you're not to live in. Between 1 and 5 millisieverts, you can ask for resettlement. There is a resettlement right to resettle, and there is financial compensation for that, and various other ways to make that a reality. And finally, from 0.5 to 1 millisievert a year is what is it called? A kind of privileged zone where you can get, where the school lunches are especially cleaned, are shipped in from outside. There are various other provisions. Now, as I said, the ICRP says, for the general public, 1 millisievert a year, no more than 1 millisievert a year of exposure. The Japanese government, when embarked on decontamination in Fukushima, said, we're going to decontaminate to 1 millisievert a year, quickly found that that wasn't possible. as we saw from Lucas's slides, you can't remediate forested land, and Fukushima is heavily wooded. I want to say, by the way, that it's wrong to just say Fukushima, because of course the plume didn't stop at the prefectural boundaries. There is also elevated pediatric thyroid cancer in the northern regions of the metropolitan era. There are hot spots in Tokyo and beyond. The Olympics are dubious because it means you're bringing in young athletes to exert themselves in what is of questionable safety, right? We're asked to forget all of that and not think about it at all. You can say, okay, they're only there for a very restricted time. True. But let us keep that in mind. But now the Japanese government, having decided that they can't decontaminate to 1 millisievert a year, have just raised the standards. I mean, when in doubt, just raise the standards, right? Raise the limits, the thresholds, lower the standards. And so now they're saying up to 20 millisieverts a year, which, according to the ICRP, is what should be the annual exposure limit for occupational safety. And even that, most people will say in the business, we try to stay way below that. The Japanese government last fall, I hadn't quite noticed this until recently, decided that because it's so hard, because the Fukushima cleanup is going to take so long and they're running out of workers with clean enough records, they just decided that the exposure limit could be raised from 100 millisievert to 150 millisievert a year. It didn't say for how long. But in any case, that has been the lesson learned so often in the case of Fukushima, and I fear in the case of the United States too, the lesson learned from Fukushima is you can't really clean up to levels that we have held up to now. So just change the standards. Just want to alert you to some of the terms that are circulating. Already talked about radiophobia. There are many, many, many proponents of radiophobia in Japan today. Another one is harmful rumors. That is to say, the reason that people won't buy products grown in Fukushima is that they've been tainted by harmful rumors. It's a version of radiophobia. It's not that there's really a problem with the food grown there, but that these selfish NIMBY-ish consumers are not willing to help out by buying. That's another slogan, help by eating. You know, eat the food from Fukushima and help everybody. Reconstruction is another term. Contribute to reconstruction. And bonds, we have bonds that bond is very, kizuna is a very beautiful Japanese word, forever tainted for me by the government's duplicitous use of it, using to, on every anniversary, to highlight the tsunami and the earthquake and never the nuclear disaster. So these are the terms that are used, and I think it's the circulation of these terms that also compels those parents of children who've been diagnosed with thyroid cancer not to show themselves fully to the public, because you are violating these taboos and as an active presence, showing that real harm is continuing. Now, things can get so distorted that you get terms like the right to return, right? Sounds good, the right to return home. Newspaper coverage says, 170,000 people are still unable to return to their homes. We should feel sorry for them. What we have to feel truly sorry for is that they can't return to a safe home, but that they're being forced to return to a dangerous one. As Fukushima parents who have evacuated say now, we're faced with the choice of having our children submit to poverty or to exposure. So I should wrap up, and I can tell you about wonderful, brave people who are also manifesting themselves in public and engaging in lawsuits. But instead, I think I'd like to show you a 2-minute clip of a film that precisely shows the Japan Fukushima Chernobyl engagement. Some of you have seen this, but maybe you'll reconsider it in this context. Okay. So, this film now, after learning a bit more about the various versions of the Chernobyl Act, they're different in Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine, each of them, of course, having to do, and I would say declining, the services provided declining according to the finances of the state, and I'm sure very far from perfect, and maybe Lucas knows a lot about how this act has been actually implemented these days. But in any case, if it has reminded me that if you acknowledge the truth and you set up provisions and you set up clinics that people can go to and take their children to by daylight and meet their fellow parents and children, they wouldn't have to be hiding their faces and altering their voices. And they wouldn't have to be. Surely, this is a most extreme form of stress. Some of the parents have indeed said that the hardest thing had been just to worry about it and to keep it secret from friends and neighbors and relatives and school officials what they were worried about. They were not. It was almost impossible to get second opinions. We also learned in that press conference from a physician who's an advisor to these the Parents Association, the Family Association, because it's not just for pediatric youth cancer, that there are indeed physicians in Fukushima who are concerned about the situation. But because they've been licensed by the state to conduct these exams, they cannot question how the exams are being conducted and what they, or to question the interpretation. So they can only provide behind the scenes. So the whole system has been set up to ensure secrecy and maximal psychological suffering on top of the actual situation, which is, of course, of enormous concern. I'll stop here. Thank you.